Well, we'll pick up where we left off on the series on the origin of false religion. But we need a brief review to have some continuity, since it's been a while since we were in that series. The foundation of all false religion began with the adversary, with Satan, and his rebellion against God and God's rule. As we understand and believe from Revelation 12, verses 3 through 4, that Satan influenced a third of the angels of God to follow him in his rebellion. And this was back before mankind was created. So the adversary had turned. He began to do what was right in his own eyes. He thought himself as being a being that had ideas that would work better than God's, apparently. So he decided, and that's one of the things that you see in Scripture that God does not care for, is that idea of doing what's right in your own eyes. But that's what Lucifer began to do, and as a result, he rebelled and became Satan. And he was able to influence a third of the angels to rebel with him. A little later, after God, and we don't know how much later because we don't have any record of time in that, but after God created Adam and Eve in this earth, Satan then influenced them to rebel as well, and we see that in Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2 and chapter 3. They rebelled by eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which God had told them not to eat of. And from that day forward, humankind has been following that path of doing what was right in their own eyes from that time forward, following self-will instead of yielding to and following God's will. And all too often, that's what we fight in our own lives. We are should be fighting. Too often we are influenced by self-will instead of humbly seeking to do what God says and follow God's will. Adam and Eve, because of their choice, were driven out of the Garden of Eden. And thus, Adam and Eve and their descendants, from the time that they were driven out of the garden, they were cut off from having access to the tree of life. And from that time forward, humankind has not had access to the spiritual knowledge of God's way of life. The knowledge of God's way of life, the spiritual truth of God's way of life, became a mystery to humankind. And we covered a whole sermon on the mysteries of God that have been hidden since the foundation of the world, as you read several times in the New Testament. The spiritual truth of God, because man does not have access to God's Spirit, pictured by having access to the tree of life, the knowledge of God's way of life, humankind has been cut off from that understanding. They don't know why they are alive. Even those who claim to be religious and study the Bible have it all wrong. They don't understand what life is all about. So under Satan's influence, because of that they rejected the knowledge of life that God would reveal and chose instead to devise their own knowledge by eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, humankind began making their own gods, devising their own systems of religion. We read of that over in Romans chapter 1. In Romans 1, starting in verse 21. And again, this is review. We covered this at that time. Romans 1, 21 says, "Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened." If you can imagine, of course, they didn't know. We use the phrase, they didn't know God from Adam, but Adam didn't know God. He had met him, God had created him, but perhaps they don't have known God for a day before Satan came on the scene as the serpent. And so they didn't know who was telling them the truth. They were telling them God and Satan told Adam and Eve two different things. God said, you eat of this tree and you're going to die. Satan said, you're not going to die. So who do you believe? Well, they didn't know either being long enough to know who was telling them the truth. But when they looked at the tree, it was a tree that looked good for food. The fruit looked good, whatever it was. They say it was an apple. Don't believe that. I don't know. Have no idea what it was. But the apple got stuck in Adam's throat, therefore you have an Adam's apple, right? Not really. But it was good for food. It looked good for food. It was pleasant to the eyes. It was a good-looking fruit. And above all, it was a tree to make one wise. If you ate this, you'd become wise. And that was appealing. It was all immediately appealing. And too often when we make mistakes, when we sin, it's because the immediate moment is more appealing than doing what God says. So because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were they thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like unto corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. So they began worshiping things that they could see. Human beings, they began worshiping. Birds, they began worshiping. Four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore God gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts to dishonor them, their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into the lie, is what the Greek actually says, not a lie. Definite article is actually there in the Greek. They changed the truth of God into the lie and worshiped and served the creature, actually creation is better, the creation more than the creator who is blessed forever. So instead of worshiping the true and the living God, who they did see, they began worshiping gods of their own making. Human beings, birds, animals, creeping things. Eventually, after the flood, they begin worshiping the sun, moon, and stars, as that form of worship also commenced after the flood. But before the flood, they worshiped the creatures that they saw around them, and they worshiped human beings. Now, if you remember, we went through quite a bit from this book, Earliest Civilizations of the Near East by James Millard. This is a book on archaeology. And because it is the earliest civilizations, this was pre-flood civilization. All of this that was recorded here was pre-flood. Now, man doesn't call it pre-flood because they don't believe in the flood, but this was pre-flood civilization. And the supreme deity of the pre-flood civilization, you can even tell by this is a woman and man, but this is a woman and child, stylized in stone. And the supreme deity, according to archaeology, of the supreme god that the ancient peoples worshipped was a mother goddess, a great mother goddess. Again, you read that many times in that book of archaeology. They worshipped as the supreme deity at that time was a mother goddess. Now, who could that have been? You read in Genesis 3, verse 20, that Eve's name was the mother of all living. Eve was the mother of all living. She became the great mother goddess, the one whose descendants of hers began worshiping her as the supreme being. All life came from her, all human life, and therefore they began worshiping her as the great mother goddess, because she was indeed the mother of all living. There was also a pre-flood trinity that you find spoken of here in this book. There was a male, a female, and the child. However, the book points out that the male deity, which would have been Adam, was not very much present. The two that were truly worshipped the most, the mother and child. So the history of mother and child, Madonna and child worship, began a long time ago. And that is one aspect of worship that is continued through today. If any of you have ever taken a trip to the feast to Italy and gone through any of the museums in Italy, virtually all of their paintings, it's either Christ on the cross or it's the Madonna and Child. Virtually, I mean, we saw so many paintings of Madonna and children, Madonna and Child, Mother and Child, going through, was that in Florence? That he said, okay, there's no need going to another room because the other room is just going to be a room full of paintings of Mother and Child. So that's basically the main theme of those paintings of that period of time. But that worship, that item of worship, those beings that are being worshipped, and realize Mary is worshipped. Mary is not just, you know, Mary is worshipped. And Mother and Child are worshipped. Now, as time went on, other descendants of Eve and Cain, especially Cain, were deified, and we went through that in some detail, and the Bible covers some of that, so that the pantheon of gods that you'll find after the flood in various of the mythological religions of Greece and Rome had their actual beginnings in human beings that lived before the flood. After the flood, please stop and remember that Noah lived 350 years after the flood. You read that in Genesis 9, verses 28 through 29. He lived for 350 years after the flood, so he lived for a total of 950 years. Long period of time. We can't imagine living that long. We can't imagine living 70 years, though I just turned 70 Thursday. Yeah, that's... Yeah. Hard to believe. My wife didn't bring, thankfully, a cake with 70 candles on it. That's a fire hazard, and so we're not going to do that. So anyway, he lived 350 years after the flood. From Genesis 11, we can calculate that Noah was 892 years old when Abram was born. So Noah died when Abram, who became Abraham, was 58 years old. So there was an overlap between Noah and Abram. And I have no doubt that Abram or Abraham knew Noah. I know he knew of him, and I imagine he knew him. And we can ask him in the first Bible study we have in the kingdom, when Abram is there or Abraham is there, we can ask him how many times and how often did he see Noah in his life. But they overlapped for 58 years. That's a long period of time as far as 350 years after the flood. Remember, the population after the flood started from 8 people. The entire post-flood civilization began from 8 people. And for a long period of time, Noah was recognized as the head of that civilization. And he was a preacher of righteousness. So they knew God. So what you read there in Romans chapter 1, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. They knew of him because Noah was there teaching about God. But just as the pre-flood society wanted to do what was right in their own eyes, humankind, without access to God's Spirit, cut off from the tree of life, also did not glorify God, the true God, as the Creator. It took some time before people began multiplying on the earth to the point that they became a pretty good-sized population. But Nimrod, whom we know, was a leader of those against God. We read that in Josephus. You don't get that as much from the scripture, except for what it says over here in Genesis 10. In Genesis 10, starting in verse 8, says, Cush begat Nimrod. Now, Cush was one of the sons of Ham, who was a son of Noah. Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham begat Cush, and Cush begat Nimrod. So Nimrod was the grandson of Ham, or the great-grandson of Noah. Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. So it mentions first that he began to be mighty among the people on the earth. Doesn't mention the people, but that's what you will assume. A mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter, and that is most likely what got his renown and recognition from the rest of the people. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. Mentions being a hunter twice. We went through, and you have to read through the middle of the lines and take some of the traditions that are written. He gained his influence by being a protector of people from wild animals. Wild animals, the animals that came through the flood on the ark, multiplied more quickly than human beings multiplied. Animals do that. Gestation periods are shorter. And the predators among those that came out, they did not continue with their fear of man after the flood. And so they began to, I'm sure, look on humankind as prey animals, if you wish, someone to prey on. And Nimrod began getting his renown among the people as being a protector, a hunter of those, and protecting the people against those wild animals. We see in verse 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, or Babylon. So he founded the city of Babylon. And Erech, remember these names, we won't read them again, but we will see them in history. Erech, Akkad, Calna, in the land of Shinar. The land of Shinar is Mesopotamia, the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, the land that is in the territory of modern-day Iraq. But he built these cities, Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calna, in the land of Shinar. And out of that land, this is actually a poor translation. You'll see in the New King James Version, and he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, is how the Hebrew actually reads. The Old King James says, and out of that land he went forth Asher, and that's wrong. The Hebrew says, and he, Nimrod, went and to Assyria and built Nineveh. Now, this is Moses writing this after, a long time after, Moses writing this after Israel came out of Egypt in their captivity. So Assyria already existed at the time of Moses. And that's why he says he went out to Assyria. There was no Assyria when Nimrod went out. Nimrod was the first ruler of Assyria. So he built, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, and Akkad, and Calna. And out of that hand he went forth to Assyria and built Nineveh and the city of Rehoboth and Calah. So Nimrod was the founder of two kingdoms, the Babylonian Empire or kingdom and the Assyrian Empire and kingdom. And it's interesting, in the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, which I brought two actual volumes today, but I didn't want to carry that much weight, so I brought some Xeroxed copied material. We don't have a Xerox anymore, but a copied material. It's funny how, you know, Kleenex is a brand, but that we call everything that's a tissue a Kleenex. Not all things are Xerox. This is What is this? I don't know. I don't remember what my printer is anymore. Anyway, but you'll see Babylon and Assyria are together. In the encyclopedia, it's not just Babylon, it's Babylon and Assyria. So they connect the two. Now, the Bible connects the two. Nimrod was the originator or the first ruler of the kingdom. He established the kingdom of Babylonia and Assyria. And you'll find them in the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. I haven't checked the current edition. The 11th edition was printed, published in 1910-1911. So these volumes are over 100 years old. I found this in a used bookstore. Sometimes you can find some good buys in a used bookstore. This is a leather-bound volume, which was nice. Now the leather has begun to deteriorate because they did not, before I got it, I tried to wax it and preserve it, but that doesn't do a good job if it has already begun to deteriorate. But found it in a used bookstore, 29 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica for $200. That's nice, because a new set is in the thousands of dollars. So it's remarkable. Now, you won't find World War II in here. You won't find World War I in here. You'll find very little on automobiles. You'll find a little bit on airplanes. But you won't find, you know, it's old. So you don't look for current events in the Encyclopedia Britannica. But Nimrod developed those two empires, the Babylonian Empire and the Assyrian Empire. Nimrod used religion to gain control over the people. Though Genesis 10 doesn't mention this, this is concluded from what is written in chapter 11 in the building of the Tower of Babel, especially if you go to Josephus' account of the building of the Tower of Babel, that it was built to resist God. And so you're dealing with religion, you're dealing with an attitude of worship. They had other gods than the true God. They did not wish to retain God in their knowledge, as you see in Romans chapter 1, verse 28. By traditional understanding, Nimrod represented himself as the priest of the sun god and the great serpent, the two enlighteners of the pre-flood and post-flood world. The sun became the object of worship that Nimrod focused on. Pre-flood world was the great mother goddess, but post-flood world, he became the high priest of the sun god and serpent worship. As I showed you the picture last time, this is an Egyptian representation of the god Ra, the falcon-headed god. But you'll see the sun orb on his head, and you probably can't see it, but there's also a serpent. This is a serpent's head and his tail here. So it's the symbol of the two great enlighteners, the sun that brings light, and of course the serpent that enlightened Adam and Eve, that opened their mind to good and evil. But Ra, the supreme god of the Egyptians, represented Nimrod. After the confusion of the languages in Genesis 11, each tribal union or tribal group had the same gods, but they had different names for those gods. And Ra was the sun god, the great enlightener. And so Nimrod first represented himself as the priest of the sun god, and they worshiped the sun and the great serpent. Both the sun and serpent pictured enlightenment. Now, the various names, as we mentioned, of those gods worshiped became different after God confounded their languages, and you read that in Genesis 11 verses 1 through 9 in the Tower of Babel. Around this time, as you know, that we covered last time, around this time of the Tower of Babel and the confusion of the languages, Apparently it was especially after God, because there were two things God did. He confused the languages and he scattered the people. He drove the various tribal groupings away from each other so they couldn't work together. And he scattered the people. And so they went into the various places that they began to develop in. And as they were in their own areas, they began having offshoots of their own religion. You know, they all had the ancient gods the same. But like anybody else, you start having your own ideas too. And so they added more gods and so on. But tradition has it that it was around that time, after the Tower of Babel and the scattering of the people, that Shem, one of the sons of Noah, actually killed Nimrod, by tradition that we understand, cut his body into pieces, and then sent those pieces to the various peoples of the earth that were scattered, where they had been scattered to, and warned them to no longer practice the religion of Nimrod, lest they would suffer the same fate as Nimrod. And so, after Shem slew Nimrod and cut him in pieces, he sent that warning to all the family groupings. And you see in the Bible, even that is a practice, a cutting into pieces and sending those pieces. You find that about the concubine of Benjamin that was cut into pieces, and also Saul cut a yoke of oxen into pieces and sent that as a warning message, or as a message out to the people. So that was a practice at that time. Well, that's a summary of about four sermons, and so we'll go from here. That brings us up to date. Now ready to break some new ground. Tradition and some histories have it that Nimrod's wife was called Semiramis. Now, if you've been in the church for very long, you've heard Semiramis. Most of us heard Semiramis, but the pronunciation is Semiramis. Nimrod's wife was called Semiramis. The 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and they must have had more time on their hands in 1910 than they do in later generations, because they spent a lot of time in going through ancient traditions and ancient histories and compiling that into material that they printed into that edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The Encyclopedia Britannica has 15 pages on Babylon and Assyria. 15 pages worth of this material. Now you have to weed through it all to find out what is of the nuggets of interest to us. But here in this article on Babylon and Assyria, we see something that relates to high priests and the office they held in that religion. This article explains the function of the high priest of the religion here on page 102 under the heading of Babylon and Assyria. I'll read a quote from this. Here in Akkad, remember, Akkad was one of the names you find in Genesis 10. Nimrod founded Babylon, Erech, and Akkad. Here in Akkad, the first Semitic empire was founded by Nimrod, the Bible says. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, and Akkad. Here in Akkad, the first Semitic empire was founded. As in Assyria, so too in the states of Babylonia, the Patesi, P-A-T-E-S-I, don't worry about that word, it's not going to be on any test yet. But the Patesi is the name that they gave to the high priest. So we'll call, whenever we come across the word, this is the high priest. In the states of Babylonia, the high priest of the god preceded the king. The state had grown up around a sanctuary the god of which was nominally its ruler. So the ruler of Babylon nominally was the sun god. And Nimrod represented himself as the priest of the sun god. So he became the nominal ruler, if you wish, of the people. The state was grown up around the sanctuary, the god of which was nominally its ruler, the human high priest being his vice regent, the one the people dealt with. In course of time, many of the high priests assumed the functions and title of king. While retaining their priestly office, they claimed at the same time to be supreme in the state in all secular concerns. So Nimrod, besides being a protector of the people and gained his influence that way, he gathered them into cities, and by archaeology you see that these are walled cities. All those ancient cities were walled cities. You find in the days of Joshua they were walled cities. That's to better protect the people from enemies. First protection was against wild animals. But what does a walled city do for you? If you happen to be the supreme leader, it gives you control. He was better able to control the people as he gathered them into cities. Eventually, the earthly king became an incarnate god, which also happened with Nimrod. After Nimrod's death, he was worshipped as a god. So that's a little tidbit from Babylonia and Assyria in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, tradition has it, as we said, that his mother became his wife, and this was Semiramis. Nimrod married his mother, and his mother therefore became his wife. Interestingly, you find that recorded in history. Here, Encyclopedia Britannica again, under the article Semiramis, which I don't know if you'll find too many articles on Semiramis or Semiramis today if you go to encyclopedias, but the old Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition has an article on Semiramis. And I'll read this to you. Have to listen to what it's saying to get how it ties in with the scriptures. Semiramis, a famous Assyrian princess. She was a famous Babylonian princess before an Assyrian princess, but it goes to Assyria first. The Assyrian Empire was founded by Nimrod. Famous Assyrian princess, around whose personality a mass of legend has accumulated. So there's a lot of tradition and legend around Semiramis. The legends run as follows. Semiramis was the daughter of the fish goddess, and I'm not going to try to pronounce her name, Atargatis. I mess it up every time I go. So, her. But a fish goddess. She was the daughter of a fish goddess. Okay. She married first one of the rulers of Assyria. Now, who was the ruler of Assyria? Nimrod. Married one of his generals first. Now, it may have been Cush. Who knows? Because Cush was Nimrod's father. Semiramis may have been Cush's wife, but he married his mother. Therefore, you can only conclude that Nimrod married his mother, Semiramis. Okay. And one of his generals was by a name of O-N-N-E-S, Onus. But he was a general of Ninus, who was the ruler. So Ninus was the ruler after Onus's death, which would have been Cush. And tradition has it that Nimrod killed Cush. We don't know, but that's the tradition. After the death of Onus, Ninus married Semiramis. That's where the son marries his mother. Okay. Ninus, who married his mother, Ninus died, and Semiramis succeeded to his power. So Ninus married his mother, married Semiramis. Ninus died. Tradition has it Shem killed him. And Semiramis succeeded to his power. She had power with her husband's son. She did not want to lose her power. You can understand that. Tradition has it she fled to Egypt. This doesn't record that. She fled to Egypt and came back with a son whom she claimed was Nimrod reborn. Okay. The encyclopedia here continues, after a 42-year reign, so she reigned for 42 years after Nimrod died, or Ninus died, she delivered up the kingdom to her son, Ninias, N-I-N-Y-A-S, and disappeared. So here the son that she had was Ninias. Semiramis claimed her son was Nimrod reborn. That's how the tradition goes. After she delivered up the kingdom to her son Ninias, she disappeared. According to what seems to be the original form of the story, she was turned into a dove and was thenceforth worshipped as a deity. She was turned into a dove and was worshipped. Now, these facts are partly to be explained, and it goes through some other material which I won't take time to read. These facts are partly to be explained by observing that according to the legends, in her birth as well as in her disappearance from earth, Semiramis appears as a goddess, the daughter of the fish goddess, and herself connected with the doves. And guess who the doves are connected with? Ishtar. I-S-H-T-A-R, the doves, spelled Ishtar, but pronounced Ishtar. Babylonian I was pronounced like an E, just like the Greek I is pronounced like an E. We say, you know, the word B-I-O-S, bios. Bios is actually a Greek word, but it's pronounced bios. So I is in many languages pronounced like an E. I would go through the German alphabet, but you may not recognize when you got to the I. H-I-J-K, Ha-I-Yot-Ka. Ha-I-Yot-Ka. H-I-J. So, same thing in German. E and I. So, it's Ishtar. And actually, when you go to the encyclopedia under Ishtar, you find the S removed, and you have Ishtar, which is interesting. Anyway, she's connected with the fish goddess, that name, and herself connected with the doves of Ishtar, or Astarte. Astarte was another name for Ishtar, which was another name for Ashtoreth. Many different names for the same goddess, Venus. Many names for the same goddess, but the different cultures, as they had different languages, called the same beings by different names. The same association of the fish and dove is found at Hierapolis, the great temple at which, according to one legend, was founded by Semiramis. The irresistible charms of Semiramis, her sexual excesses, and other features of legend all bear out the view that she is primarily a form of Astarte, and so fittingly conceived as the great queen of Assyria. You also find her referred to as the queen of heaven in the Old Testament. Professor Lehman Haupt, by putting together the results of archaeological discoveries, has arrived at the following conclusions. Semiramis is the Greek form of Semiramat, okay. She was probably a Babylonian, not probably, she was a Babylonian, For it was she who imposed the Babylonian cult of Nebo or Nabu, Nimrod, different names, on the Syrian religion. And then it says down here, Ninus, which we read up here, Ninus married her, but it says down here, Ninus was her son. And that's the first place I'd ever read that other than tradition. So, Ninus was her son, but she was also the mother, the wife of Ninus. Ninus was her son, and she also married Ninus. A popular etymology which connected the name with the Assyrian sumat or dove seems to have first started with the identification of the historical Semiramis with the goddess Ishtar and her doves. So this was the ancient beginnings of that cult of Easter. We simply call it Easter. But that's the first place that I've ever seen that she married Ninus, but Ninus was also her son. Now, this article that we just read incorporates some of the traditional views that we've heard. I've heard all my life, but it has some of the facts or some of the support for what we used to have always believed traditionally. Nimrod, or Ninus, married his mother. Ninus was the ruler of Assyria, which we get from Scripture. He went out and to Assyria and built Nineveh. Semiramis ruled by herself after Nimrod's death. This says for 42 years. She is associated with the goddess of Ishtar of the Babylonians, which is the same as Ashtoreth of the Old Testament, 1 Kings, and Astarte of the Phoenicians. But here in 1 Kings 11:5, so it is this religion, and we'll see more of that, is what plagued the Israelites since they did not remove all of the inhabitants of the promised land from their midst, and the gods of those people became snares to Israel. And those gods were the sun god. Now, we talk about Ishtar, we talk about Astarte, we talk about Ashtoreth, Venus, and so on. All of these are various names of the fertility goddess. The fertility goddess. Goddess of childbirth. 1 Kings 11:5. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians. Ashtoreth, another name for Astarte, another name for Ishtar, another name for Semiramis, if you wish. And after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon, because of his 700 concubines and 300 wives, left God and started seeking after the gods of his wives and concubines. And he built high places for them and so on. He worshipped Chemosh, Molech, and so on. Molech was another one of the sun gods, fire gods, if you wish. According to tradition, after Nimrod's death, remember we said Semiramis fled to Egypt. She didn't wish to lose her power and the rule that she had with Nimrod. So she returned with a son, claiming that the son, this Ninias, N-I-N-Y-A-S, as the encyclopedia has it, claimed that this son was Nimrod reborn. So she was the mother of Nimrod and also the mother of this Ninias. But because of the warning of death on those who practiced the religion of Nimrod, she now taught a religion of symbolism. It was not an open worship of these beings and these ideas, but it was done in symbol. And those symbols were only understood by the fully initiated. I don't know if anybody here was ever a Mason, but you don't understand the Masonic symbols unless you're fully a Mason, and then you learn the symbolic meaning or the actual meaning of the symbols. I was never a Mason, so I can't tell you, but I have known several Masons. But Semiramis, because of the warning about practicing Nimrod's religion, came back teaching a religion of symbolism. And that symbolism continues to today. It's also the religion that she brought back, since it was a Babylonian religion. It is called Mystery Babylon the Great in Revelation. Mystery Babylon the Great. I think that's Revelation 17. She apparently revived the pre-flood mother goddess worship in symbol after the feast. Remember, Nimrod himself was the high priest of the sun god. No mother goddess room there. But after Nimrod's death and her coming back from Egypt with a child, she revived the Madonna child worship, the great mother goddess worship, which is what Ishtar was called, which is what Astarte was called, and Ashtoreth, the mother goddess, the great mother goddess, the great fertility goddess, the goddess of all living. She became deified by later generations as the various fertility goddesses in the various countries and their languages where she continued to be worshipped. Ishtar, or Ishtar, was the Babylonian and Assyrian goddess of fertility. Go to the encyclopedia on that. And there's a fairly lengthy article on Ishtar, spelled either with the H or without the H, and the I pronounced as an E. So Ishtar is the name of the chief goddess of the Babylonian and Assyrian empires, the counterpart of the Phoenician Astarte. Where the name originated is likewise uncertain, but the indications point to Erech. If you remember, Erech is one of the cities we mentioned in Genesis 10. The name originated, the indication is that it was originated in Erech, where we find the worship of a great mother goddess, independent of any association with a male counterpart, flourishing in the oldest period of Babylonian history. It's interesting that Easter worship, or Ishtar worship, many of the gods transform themselves through the centuries, but she is the one goddess that isn't changed at all. Her characteristic does not change from century to century. Ishtar is the one goddess in the pantheon who retains her independent position despite and throughout all changes that the Babylonian Assyrian religion undergoes. We may reasonably assume that the analogy drawn from the process of reproduction among men and animals led to the conception of a female deity presiding over the life of the universe. The female deity that presided over the life of the universe. Interesting. But there were two aspects of the goddess of life. She brings forth, she fertilizes the field, she clothes nature in joy and gladness. But she also withdraws her favors, and when she does so, the fields wither, and men and animals cease to produce. In place of life, barrenness and death ensue. She is thus also a grim goddess, at once cruel and destructive. We can therefore understand that she was also invoked as the goddess of war. Closely allied with this myth of Ishtar, and personifying another view of the change of seasons is the story of Ishtar's love for Tammuz. Now, if you look in Scripture, you'll find the name Tammuz. And Ishtar, her love was Tammuz, her husband and her son, and her son reborn, symbolizing the springtime. But as midsummer approaches, her husband is slain, according to one version. It is for the purpose of saving Tammuz from the clutches of the goddess of the netherworld that she enters upon her journey to that region. There are a couple different myths that come out of this, and I'm sure you both can recognize those myths. The Tammuz cult is mentioned over here in Ezekiel 8. Ezekiel 8 and verse 14. Again, this is in Israel, in Ezekiel chapter 8, and verse 14. You read the entire chapter, and it's talking about a number of abominations that the Israelites had begun following. Pick it up in verse 13. And he said also unto me, turn you again, and you shall see greater abominations that they do. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, brought Ezekiel in vision to the temple of God, the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz, because Tammuz had been slain. The god, the sun god, was dying. And the cult tradition has it that Ishtar went to the netherworld to try and get him back. And all the women were weeping to try to help her get Tammuz back out of the netherworld. Now, let me get my book so it don't slide off the lectern up here. There's a modern day observance that goes right along with this. It's not Christmas, that's a different one. But if you've ever lived in Mobile, Alabama, or New Orleans, you understand their tradition very well. It's the modern day observance of Mardi Gras, which ends on Fat Tuesday, the 7 days of Mardi Gras that ends with a big bash. And Mardi Gras is not known for temperance. I'm sure you understand that. It's not known for restraint. It's known for excess. Okay. Mardi Gras ends on Fat Tuesday, which is right before Ash Wednesday. Okay. When you repent of all the things you did on Fat Tuesday and before. And then you fast for 40 days of Lent, fasting and mourning, women weeping for Tammuz, which they don't understand fasting, because you can give up chewing gum, and as long as you don't have chewing gum, then you're okay. That begins Lent. But what does Lent end with? It ends with Easter, the celebration of new life, springtime. Not the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but that's what Christianity today put on it. But what do rabbits and eggs have to do with the resurrection of Christ? Nothing. But what do they have to do with a fertility goddess? Everything, because those are some of her symbols. Symbols of fertility. So on Easter, what do they have? You have egg rolls, and you have little chocolate bunnies, or real live bunnies. you have rabbits and eggs. Mardi Gras is the big party that kicks off 40 days of mourning and ends with the rejoicing of new life, the return of Tammuz back to life in the springtime. Anybody ever, well, we lived in Mobile for 8.5 years, so we understand. Mobile and New Orleans had a competition, a friendly rivalry. New Orleans says that they began Mardi Gras, or Mardi Gras in the United States. Mobile says it first began in Mobile. So there was this rivalry between the two cities. But at Mardi Gras time, there is always a choosing of a king and queen of Mardi Gras. Anybody familiar with that? Well, let's just read what we have here. This is from the Unger's Bible Dictionary under the article of Tammuz. Tammuz supposedly died every autumn when he departed to the underworld. Thence he was recovered by the disconsolate Ishtar. His reappearance marked the bursting forth of life in the springtime. The worship of this god was widespread throughout the Fertile Crescent from Babylonia, Assyria, to Palestine, Syria. The rites of Tammuz included a divine marriage of the king annually to the fertility goddess in the person of a temple priestess. And that is the prior tradition that the king and queen of Mardi Gras is based on. Every year they choose a king and a queen, and there's a symbolic marriage between them, and you're a great social occasion. You know, if you're chosen the king of Mardi Gras or the queen of Mardi Gras, then you're really high on the social ladder, okay, in those days and age, or at this day and age. So this is just a tradition that continues on through today. Ishtar, Astarte, Ashtoreth, Asherah are all different names for the Queen of Heaven of Jeremiah 7. Jeremiah 7, verse 18. Jeremiah 7 and verse 18. The children gather wood, and the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead their dough to make cakes to the queen of heaven, Ishtar, Astarte, Ashtoreth, same being, the queen of heaven, to pour out drink offerings unto her or unto other gods, that they may provoke me to anger, God says. Anybody ever hear of hot cross buns? When were they baked? Around Christmas or around Easter? Easter. It's amazing that tradition still carries on. They were baking cakes to the Queen of Heaven at the time of Easter, because that's her day. And around Easter time, you have hot cross buns being baked, which is fascinating. And that's just one of the days of worship that the Babylonians observed. They also observed one after the turn of the solstice, the winter solstice. Another part, obviously, is the symbolic return to life of the sun god on December 25th. Remember, December 20th through 22nd, can't remember exactly the date, is the winter solstice, when the shortest day of the year, the sun continues to die, but after the solstice, the sun comes back to life because the days get longer. And there was a celebration on December 25th in the Babylonian world, Assyrian world, pagan world, because that spread to Rome and Egypt and elsewhere, of the rebirth of the sun god. And it was no great difficulty to then call that day the birth of the Son of God. And that's why you end up with December 25th as the date of Christ's birth, simply attaching to that ancient pagan tradition the rebirth of the sun god and calling it now the birth of the Son of God. Anybody ever hear of Yule logs? Yuletide greetings. The Yule time is Christmas time. The old tradition, very few people practice that. The old tradition was you burnt the Yule log Christmas Eve. And every kids go to bed. And from its ashes come a new young tree, an evergreen tree in Europe. So from its ashes, from the death of Nimrod, comes Nimrod reborn. Okay, in a green tree. We used to put our Christmas trees up, because I used to keep Christmas, on Christmas Eve. Now they put them up after Halloween, or in June or July. It's a lot different today. But the old tradition was you put it up, the old tradition was you put it up Christmas Eve. And it was up through New Year's. Now the merchants have gotten involved and they want it starting after Halloween. You don't see Thanksgiving anymore, hardly. You go from Halloween to Christmas. So you have the Yule logs, you have wassailing. I don't know if you've ever heard of wassailing. Here we go, a wassailing. The wassail bowl was a big punch bowl that was more spike than punch. Okay. And after you drunk your full, you went out wassailing, singing in the streets, if you wish. And people still sing in the streets. At least they, I don't know if they do it anymore, but that's Christmas caroling, where that came from. Wassailing in the streets. But they, thankfully, they're not drunk anymore. But there's all kinds of traditions that go back to that. So all to bring the heathen into the church, you simply put Christ's name on Babylonian traditions. But how did this idea get into being? How did these heathen traditions, pagan traditions, Babylonian traditions, get into Christianity? Well, that's the next time. We'll cover that in some detail.